Let's change gears here for a moment and switch from developing simple technique to developing a cultural awareness of language. Tom Lopez talks of his experiences working with third world and minority actors.
And so working with third world performers, I mean, they'd never get a chance to perform. I mean, you know, they'll get, even in New York, you know, they'll get maybe two, because I did a series of Asian Indian short stories, and they're all, you know, the performers, just practically all of them, except in a rare case where I couldn't find an older man, I had someone who was English, do a slight Indian accent. But I brought in consultants that were Indians that I was working with, and you know, and we worked on it to where I said, is this acceptable, you know? Well, there was one funny thing that happened working with these performers, because there was a word and I wasn't sure how you pronounced it, and so I think there's seven Asian Indians, you know, all living in New York, but all from India. And I said, how do you pronounce this? I get seven different pronunciations, because India is like 15 or something different countries and different languages. The beauty of it is you can learn so much in the process of working with people other than your normal white middle class, blah, blah, blah. It makes it far more interesting, and yeah, it's good for you. Good for me. Working with some of the Hispanic actors in New York, they say, what? Do you realize how much money and how long it took me to get rid of my accent? You want me to put my accent back in again? You know, this sort of thing.
You know, what did you expect?
Yeah, you know. And also, too, often when you're working with black actors, you can't tell the difference. And so you have to decide, do you want them to sound a little more black or what? And so you talk to them about it, you know. But you also talk to them about the character, because you feel, if you're brought up in the Midwest and maybe you know didn't have anyone who was black, who was a friend until college or something, you know, and you really feel kind of inadequate, you're not doing some street type stereotype or something like that, you're trying to develop human beings, well, you know, you work with the actor or you work with friends and so on.
Now listen to Michael Miller as he discusses the specific challenges he and Eric Wilson found playing inner city blacks in B.B. Moore Campbell's Sugar on the Floor, directed by Marjorie Van Haltern.
I think one of the most important things for us in preparing ourselves for the more urbanized black was coming to realize that we as young black men were not the stereotypical city urban blacks as far as our articulation and that sort of thing. So what we had to do was talk to other urban blacks who had what was considered the appropriate speech. We talked with them about their inflection, about their dialect, the dialogue. We spent time with them, and we talked about it amongst ourselves. And then we worked on it separately and together in order to get that a more urban feel. Well, for one thing is over-articulation, what would be considered over-articulation. For instance, I'm saying what would be considered over-articulation. Or I could say, you know, something like that. You know what I'm saying? It's the word choice. Word choices are unconventional by standard language guidelines. Looser, more fluid, more emphasis on inflection and less on diction. Normally, I would say, hey, what's the matter with you? What is the matter with you? What's the matter with you? Which is really slightly different from, hey, man, what's the matter with you, man?
Who the hell is it?
It's Mickey, man. Open the door.
Come on in, man. Hey, turn that down, man. I gotta talk to you.
Hi.
You got any milk?
Ain't no food in there, man. Carolyn ain't bought no groceries. That bitch don't want to take care of me, man. I'm out the door, because I got other places. What's wrong, man?
Don't worry about it. My stomach's been acting up lately. Listen, I've been thinking. Maybe there's a way that we can get a death certificate. A phony one.
Man, how you gonna do that? You know anybody that works where they print up death certificates?
Well, maybe we could get your lawyer. What's his name? That light-skinned dude.
You talking about Leroy Scott, ain't you?
Yeah, him. Pay him to do some divorce papers. Yeah. Kind of after the fact.
Well, you can forget about that, man, because I owe Leroy Scott from the last time I got busted. Oh, and besides, with our mama's insurance, we ain't got the money to pay nobody to do nothing. We gotta go to him.
Who?
Who you think, Mickey?
Of course, the voice you use has to match the part you play, technically and emotionally. So be very careful and specific about how your character voice matches the feel and emotional direction of the script. Lindsay Ellison.
But I do think that some voices just require technique, that's all. They're just surface voices. And you can switch back and forth really quickly in that sense. But if you're doing an emotive character voice, It's really you drawing it more from the inside rather than just from the articulation.
Listen to Walter Elliott's performance in The Halberdier of the Little Rheinschloss. This is a broad comic O. Henry story adapted for radio by David Osman.
Mein Gott, you was right. Ein Halberdier has not got the business to dish up the soup. You, I will not discharge.
Thank you, Herr Brachman.
What about my dress?
Yes, what about the dress?
Oh, bad luck.
Mein Herr, you go ahead and sue me with the dress. Sue me for $600 or $6,000. I will stand by the suit. Now you have another waiter if you like, or let mine halberdier go back and stand guard with his halberd. And that is my final word.
Now compare Walter's comic German accent with his dramatic portrayal of a Jewish storekeeper in Revenge by Dan Skinner. You can hear similar inflections, but listen to the completely different emotional feel to match the character in the play. You'll also hear the voice of Otis McClay as Professor Marx.
We can never forget. We can only make sure it doesn't happen again.
Santa Anna again?
No, another wise man.
Who?
You, Professor Marx. You said it the last time you were here, and you were right.
But is it enough?
If we don't forget and if we don't let others forget, it's enough. To paraphrase Santa Anna again, it's those who cannot remember the past that are condemned to repeat it. So today's a new day. It's Wednesday. You know what that means?
No.
Blintzes. I'll bet you haven't had those in a while.
I'm not hungry, and I have to work.
Not now. Tonight, you come by my house. My wife makes the most fantastic blueberry blintzes the mystery of science can raise for one night.
Sometimes you may have to change more than just your emotions to get your character's voice. Tom Lopez, David Osman, Richard Fish, and Michael Miller all discuss the need for physically becoming your character.
Walk behind people and walk the way they walk, and you really get a sense of their character, their state of mind particularly. And so he would do that. He'd get behind somebody and walk along. And he really got a sense of what mood they were in just by assuming their pose. And shortly after, when I was in Morocco, I would notice that the street hustlers, I'd be walking down the street, and some young guy would slide up to me. And at first I didn't notice that how he could talk exactly where my mind was. He'd just come like right in, hey man, how you doing? How's things going? So on. I mean, he was talking to me as though we'd been talking for the last half hour. I look over, he had unconsciously probably assumed exactly the way I was walking, my stride, my posture, everything.
You can't play every role planted four square or whatever. I find that I have a lot of characterizations that I do require me to stand in a particular way so that this is all you've got to work with, It's just like playing the oboe or something. You have this column of air.
I find myself moving a lot and doing gestures and doing even facial expressions and so forth.
Physicality and the actual verbal expression, they work hand in hand. They work off each other. I don't think you can accurately get a feeling, an articulation of the words without moving your body, gesturing in ways that will suggest for you mentally and kinesthetically what it is you mean to say. That was one of the great things about working with Marjorie, is that we actually got to move around and we actually got to use our bodies to effectively communicate more than just the verbal aspect, is also the physical aspect.
In this scene from Sugar on the Floor, director Marjorie Van Haltren kept Michael Miller and Eric Wilson in emotional voice and character by recording the scene on location with a mobile microphone. Listen carefully as the scene explodes when they literally explode from their car to chase and confront each other.
I was the only one who believed that.
Pop told me you were gonna try something crazy.
He ain't your family, Mickey. He's trying to make you think he's your family, but it's just you and me. We can't go to no college.
No,
and
Judy,
there's only
listen.
One chance we got, and that's the money.
Judy, listen to me.
No, you listen. I'm an ex-con, high school dropout, dark skin, nappy-headed, dangerous-looking black man with a big Jimmy in his pants. The last job I had was scooping fries at Mickey D's in 1982, and that's my next job, Mickey. I'm 26 years old, and I ain't got nothing but a check I can't cash unless a man dies, and I'm gonna make my move.
What are you gonna do about Khalil?
I don't want to talk about my kid, Mickey.
Wait, Judy, a murderer for a father. Oh, well, maybe that's better. Maybe he can tell all his friends that his daddy didn't feed him because he was in a joint. Why don't you feed him, Junie?
Don't talk about him.
Denise, that bitch.
It ain't Denise. It's you, Junie. You the one with all the problems. You ain't no better than him. Junie, you right. You ain't nothing. And I'm ashamed to be your brother.
Here's another tip from Tina Hubbs.
I just thought I'd throw this out. I learned this trick from a disc jockey who came to one of the first MRTWs. He did a lot of voices, character voices, on his program, comedy routines.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick was, a lot of people didn't know that he was doing the other voice. And he said, the way you do that is you start out and you're asking a question of the other you person. Mm-hmm. And you don't take a breath in between the other voice starting.
Ah.
You start up and you ask your voice and you say, well, how are you doing today? Oh, I'm doing okay. And you don't take the breath in there, and people just...
That's right.
Get fooled by that.
No, you know, we ain't got a problem. I ain't got no girls for a party. Now, how can you have a party with no girls? And why are we going to do that?
Hey, don't worry. All we got to do, have a little drink and poo, everything going to be okay.
Well, that was Dan Coffey practicing the technique Tina just preached. And how about just being silly? Peter Bergman, Dan Coffey, Lindsay Ellison, and David Osman talk about the development and discovery of funny voices. After all, talking crazy is a great American radio tradition.
Where do funny voices come from? Well, funny voices are... As far as I can see, they have to do with mimicry, and mimicry is a very solid weapon when you're a child against older, bigger, stronger, more pompous people. Teachers who oppress you, parents who don't understand you, you know, you can indeed mimic them. If you don't mimic the way that they walk, then you mimic the way that they talk. Where did we learn our funny voices? From cartoons. Now, if you think about it, if you are an alien, which some of you probably are, and you were to come here to this space from that space, right, and the first thing you were to pick up in your spaceship, right, after the ads were, or the first thing you were to pick up was a cartoon, you would think we were crazy. Because everybody speaks in a truly funny voice, you know. Either they have an accent, or, well, they have a funny voice. Accents are just a type of funny voice. So if you want to develop a funny voice, then admit to the world that you watch a lot more cartoons than you will admit you watch. And pay attention to them. Even the cheap Japanese-style ones with only the... How's that? Oh.
Those despicable Mises, I am going to tear those Mises to pieces.
Exit, stage left even, maybe.
Boo-boo, what do you say we give Ranger Smith a problem?
I would say my favorite person was Mel Blanc, because he could do so many voices, and I think he must have been a little nuts. And of course, I also think that people who are comedians and funny and can do those voices have to be real serious too, because any of those voices that Mel did, he had to know those characters, and he had to stay real constant with those characters. So in doing a funny voice, you have to really dip into and stay steady with, you know, one particular pot of humor that you might have drawn up, you know.
Which brings up the problem of, how do you do that? What's funny about this guy? What am I going to do? I don't know. I had a character named Chester Cadaver, who was a government official. And he has on I think it's on the Bozo's record, right? He has one of the weirdest voices I ever came up with, and have never done it before or since, but it was because there was nothing else available, reaching to somehow in the bottom of the barrel and scraping around to try to find a truly funny voice, because it didn't matter, because he was just a bureaucrat. You could make fun of him. And he had Clive. He's had just the strangest voice. He came from nowhere to
like
do that
bureaucrats.
To do that one part and disappeared. So don't be afraid to reach a long ways if it's a situation where, instead of doing that bad English accent, you know.
Now, let's take a little tour of the wonderful world of impressions with Richard Fish, Lindsay Fusel, and David Osman in this scene from the Ronald Reagan murder case.
Barry Fitzgerald is over there. He has a big hit right now with Bells of St. Bingles, you know.
Oh, lads, I'm telling you, we always said potato back in Old County Cork.
Oh, it sounds like he's teaching Irish dialect again, too. Oh, it's Cary Grant and Bela Lugosi.
You say potato and I say spud. Let's call the whole thing off. Well, Georgie.
Cary, how are you today?
Blur, how do you do? Tire biter. I like that. But
doesn't it give you gas?
Oh, Bela, get your hand off my neck, Bela. Oh, please. Oh, there's Jerry Colonna on the patio.
Ah, yes.
Dancing the Walter Winchell Roomba with Mae West. Afternoon, Mae.
Hiya, Georgie. Is that a microphone in your pocket, or are you just glad to see me?
I keep telling you, Mae, it's a banana.
Richard Fish.
Impressions are when you want to imitate a specific person. And really, I backed into those. I did not set out one day and decide I was going to be an impressionist initially. When I was about 10 years old, John F. Kennedy was president, and Vaughn Meader came out with an album, a comedy record album, called The First Family. And he did an impression of JFK, and I was listening to it. And one day, I'm age 10, I found suddenly that I could do the JFK voice in one particular phrase. I think it was a sketch where JFK was bargaining with the rest of his family about who would have what toys in the bathtub, or something silly like that. And the phrase was, "You, John F. Kennedy, you drive a hard bargain." And suddenly the hard bargain, the Boston accent there hit me, and I could do that phrase. I found I could do that phrase. That became a door into the voice. When you're doing an impression, I find that what happens is that you develop a door, a phrase or a word or an expression that you can do. It's the first thing usually that you're able to do that works in your own mind and sounds to you like it's supposed to sound. And then, from then on, when you want to get into that character, do that phrase once, click, and your mind is there. Now, like anything else, doing impressions, the first one is a lot harder than the fifth or the tenth or the 20th. The word "well" is a very common door to a number of voices.
"Well, I'm Ronald Reagan, and that's the way it goes. Well, welp,"
or in Reagan's case, W-E-L-L-P, welp.
"Welp, Nancy and I were just talking."
And that is my door to Reagan. But the same word is my door to Jimmy Stewart, pronounced differently. "Well, Jim Stewart, well, just W-A-L, you know, well, Jim Stewart." And again, the word "well" can also be a door to Jack Benny. "Well," except my door to Jack is probably the word "gosh." "Gosh, Jack Benny," you know. Almost every voice you do has some kind of phrase. Something else about impressions. When working up an impression, it is often easier to take your initial lesson not from the subject itself, but from an impressionist. When an impressionist does a character, they will exaggerate particular features of the character, the most recognizable features of the character and the voice. And when you take your first lesson by going to Rich Little or one of the impressionists, you hear immediately what they have chosen to exaggerate. And you may find your door a lot easier to get from an impressionist. However, it's then very worthwhile to refer back to the original. The first impression I ever deliberately decided to do was W.C. Fields, and I found that very difficult initially. I steeped myself in Fields. I watched two or three of his movies on tape. I read W.C. Fields' collected papers published by his grandson, and I read something he'd written, and I kind of steeped myself in him for a couple of 3 weeks. And then I went into the studio and did the lines in the script one at a time, taking each line and doing it 20 or 30 times and listening back and picking the right take and assembling it all by editing. That studio technique turns out to be a wonderful way to learn a lot about voices in general, and especially to learn impressions.
"Ah, yes, my door into Fields is the phrase, ah, yes. Or perhaps, don't mind if I do, yes, indeed."
Another thing about impressions, I find that my normal voice range in pitch is sometimes a little bit too high or a little bit too low for a given impression, and when I can get into the studio and use a little bit of variable speed, sometimes it sounds a lot better to me. I used to do Humphrey Bogart, and to me, my voice used to sound a little too high for Humphrey Bogart. And 10 years ago, I would slow the tape down just a little bit.
So, there you have it. Your own voice, your characters, and your impressions. Remember, listen and practice. Listen and practice as much as you can. Michael Miller and Lindsay Ellison add these final thoughts.
I think one of the most important things I've found about doing accents is that a lot of it is concept. A lot of it is thinking from the perspective of where the accent is spoken. If you're speaking an English accent, think about how the people in England live. Think about their concerns, what they see every day. The people in Philadelphia and certain parts of Philadelphia, the way they live and what they see and how they use communication to live their lives the way they talk very fast in New York because it's fast-paced, action, bustling city. And then in the Midwest, it's slower. You know, you got your farms and life is a lot slower. So if you think conceptually, I think that aids in your understanding of the language, and you'll probably handle the accents differently and more with more compassion and understanding.
For me, the excuse of letting down all of those barriers and being 16 different voices, it's beautiful. I love it.
Wise men say. We hope this tape has helped, challenged, and encouraged you to be a part of radio theater. Our thanks go to Richard Fish, Lindsay Ellison, David Osman, Peter Bergman, Shelley Carlson, Tom Lopez, Michael Miller, Mark Decker, Vanessa Whitburn, and Dan Coffey. Or was that Elvis? For more words on acting and voice training, we invite you to listen to the MRTW Acting for Radio cassette. The Midwest Radio Theater Workshop is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Missouri Arts Council, the City of Columbia Arts Commission, and KOPN-FM Radio. MRTW is directed by Diane Huneke and is located at 915 East Broadway, Columbia, Missouri, 65201. This cassette was produced and edited by Brian Price, and I'm Roger Studi. Thanks a lot, and stay in character. Take my whole life to falling in love with you. No harm.
Dr. Science, everybody. Another hand for Dr. Science.